Mr. Thomas Auld, the slaveholding owner of a plantation on Maryland's eastern shore, summoned back his slave Frederick Douglass, 15 years old at the time, from Baltimore, where Douglass had just spent 7 years serving Auld's brother. Now he was needed to work the fields of the plantation. But life in the city had changed Douglass in many ways, and to his chagrin, he found it quite hard to disguise this from Auld. In Baltimore, he had secretly managed to teach himself how to read and write, something no slave was allowed to do, for that would stimulate dangerous thoughts. On the plantation, Douglass tried to teach as many slaves as possible to read. These efforts were quickly squashed. But what was worse for him was that he had developed a rather defiant attitude, what the slaveholder called impudence. He talked back to Auld, questioned some of his orders, and played all kinds of tricks to get more food. Auld was notorious for keeping his slaves near starvation. One day, Auld informed Douglass that he was hiring him out for a year to Mr. Edward Covey, a nearby farm renter who had earned a reputation as a consummate breaker of young Negroes. Slaveholders would send them their most difficult slaves, and in exchange for their free labor, Covey would beat every last ounce of rebellion out of them. Covey worked Douglass especially hard, and after a few months he was broken in body and spirit. He no longer desired to read books or engage in discussions with his fellow slaves. On his days off, he would crawl under the shade of a tree and sleep off his exhaustion and despair. One especially hot day in August 1834, Douglass became ill and fainted. The next thing he knew, Covey was hovering over him, hickory slab in hand, ordering him back to work. But Douglass was too weak. Covey hit him on the head, opening a deep wound. He kicked him a few times, but Douglass could not move. Covey finally left, intending to deal with him later. Douglass managed to get to his feet, staggered to the woods, and somehow made his way back to Auld's plantation. There he begged with Master Auld to keep him there, explaining Covey's cruelty. Auld was unmoved. Douglass could spend the night, but then he must return to Covey's farm. Making his way back to the farm, Douglass feared the worst. He told himself that he would do his best to obey Covey and somehow survive the weeks ahead. Arriving at the stables where he was supposed to work that day, he began his chores, when out of nowhere, like a snake, Covey slithered in, rope in hand. He lunged at Douglass, trying to get a slipknot on his leg and tie him up. He was clearly intending the thrashing to end all thrashings. Risking an even more intense beating, Douglass pushed Covey away, and without hitting him, kept him from getting the rope around his leg. At that moment, something clicked in Douglass's head. Every defiant thought that had been suffocated by his months of brutal labor came back to him. He was not afraid. Covey could kill him, but it was better to go down fighting for his life. Suddenly a cousin came to Covey's aid, and finding himself surrounded, Douglass did the unthinkable. He swung hard at the man and knocked him to the ground. Hitting a white man would most likely lead to his hanging. A fighting madness came over Douglass. He returned Covey's blows. The struggle went on for 2 hours, until, bloodied, exhausted, and gasping for breath, Covey gave up, and slowly staggered back to his house. Douglass could only assume that Covey would now come after him with a gun or find some other way to kill him. It never happened. Slowly it dawned on Douglass. To kill him, or punish him in some powerful way, posed too great a risk. Word would get out that Covey had failed to break a Negro this one time, had had to resort to a gun when his terror tactics did not work. The mere hint of that would ruin his reputation far and wide, and his job depended on his perfect reputation. Better to leave the wild 16-year-old slave alone than risk the kind of crazy or unpredictable response Douglass had shown himself capable of. Better to let him calm down and go quietly away when his time of service there was over. For the rest of Douglass's stay with Covey, the white man did not lay a hand on him. Douglass had noticed that slaveholders often prefer to whip those who are most easily whipped. Now he had learned the lesson for himself. Never again would he be submissive. Such weakness only encouraged the tyrants to go further. He would rather risk death, returning blow for blow with his fists or his wits. Interpretation. Reflecting on this moment years later in his book, My Bondage and My Freedom, after he had escaped to the North and become a leading advocate of the abolitionist movement, Douglas wrote, "This battle with Mr. Covey was the turning point in my life as a slave. I was a changed being after that fight. I had reached the point at which I was not afraid to die. This spirit made me a free man in fact, while I remained a slave in form." For the rest of his life, he adopted this fighting stance. By being unafraid of the consequences, Douglas gained a degree of control of his situation both physically and psychologically. Once he had rooted fear out of himself, he opened up possibilities for action. Sometimes fighting back overtly, sometimes being clever and deceitful. From a slave with no control, he became a man with some options and some power, all of which he leveraged into real freedom when the time came. To control the dynamic, you must be able to control yourself and your emotions. Getting angry and lashing out will only limit your options. And in conflict, fear is the most debilitating emotion of all. Even before anything has happened, your fear puts you on your heels, cedes the initiative to the enemy. The other side has endless possibilities for using your fear to help control you, keep you on the defensive. Those who are tyrants and domineering types can smell your anxiety, and it makes them even more tyrannical. Before anything else, you must lose your fear of death, of the consequences of a bold maneuver, of other people's opinion of you. That single moment will suddenly open up vistas of possibilities, and in the end, whichever side has more possibilities for positive action has greater control. 5. Early in his career, the American psychiatrist Milton H. Erickson, 1901-80, noticed that patients had countless ways of controlling the relationship between patient and therapist. They might withhold information from him or resist entering into a hypnotic trance. Erickson often used hypnosis in his therapy. They might question the therapist's abilities, insist he do more of the talking, or emphasize the hopelessness of their problems and the futility of therapy. These attempts at control, in fact, mirrored whatever their problem was in daily life. They resorted to all kinds of unconscious and passive games of domination while denying to themselves and to others that they were up to such tricks. And so, over the years, Erickson developed what he called his utilization technique, literally, using these patients' passive aggression, their clever manipulations, as instruments to change them. Erickson often dealt with patients whom someone else, a partner, a parent, had forced to seek his help. Resentful of this, they would get revenge by deliberately withholding information about their lives. Erickson would begin by telling these patients that it was natural, even healthy, not to want to reveal everything to the therapist. He would insist they withhold any sensitive information. The patients would then feel trapped. By keeping secrets, they were obeying the therapist, which was just the opposite of what they wanted to do. Usually, by the second session, they would open up, rebelling to such an extent that they revealed everything about themselves. One man, on his first visit to Erickson's office, began anxiously pacing the room. By refusing to sit down and relax, he was making it impossible for Erickson to hypnotize him or work with him at all. Erickson began by asking him, "Are you willing to cooperate with me by continuing to pace the floor, as you are doing now?" The patient agreed to this strange request. Then Erickson asked if he could tell the patient where to pace and how fast. The patient could see no problem with this. Minutes later, Erickson began to hesitate in giving his directions. The patient waited to hear what he was to do next with his pacing. After this happened a few times, Erickson finally told him to sit in a chair, where the man promptly fell into a trance. With those who were patently cynical about therapy, Erickson would deliberately try a method of hypnosis that would fail, and then he would apologize for using that technique. He would talk about his own inadequacies and the many times he had failed. Erickson knew that these types needed to one-up the therapist, and that once they felt they had gained the advantage, they would unconsciously open themselves up to him and fall easily into a trance. A woman once came to Erickson complaining that her husband used his supposedly weak heart to keep her on constant alert and dominate her in every way. The doctors had found nothing wrong with him, yet he genuinely seemed weak and always believed that a heart attack was imminent. The woman felt concerned, angry, and guilty all at the same time. Erickson advised her to continue being sympathetic to his condition, but the next time he talked about a heart attack, she was to tell him politely she needed to tidy the house. She was then to place brochures she had collected from morticians all around the house. If he did it again, she was to go to the desk in the living room and begin adding up the figures in his life insurance policies. At first the husband was furious, but soon he came to fear seeing those brochures and hearing the sound of the adding machine. He stopped talking about his heart and was forced to deal with his wife in a more direct manner. Interpretation. In some relationships, you may have a gnawing feeling that the other person has gained control of the dynamic, yet you find it hard to pinpoint how or when this occurred. All that can be said for certain is that you feel unable to move the other person, to influence the course of the relationship. Everything you do only seems to feed the power of the controller. The reason for this is that the other person has adopted subtle, insidious forms of control that are easily disguised and yet all the more effective for being unconscious and passive. Such types exert control by being depressed, overly anxious, overburdened with work. They are the victims of constant injustice. They cannot help their situation. They demand attention, and if you fail to provide it, they make you feel guilty. They are elusive and impossible to fight because they make it appear at each turn that they are not at all looking for control. They are more willful than you, but better at disguising it. In truth, you are the one who feels helpless and confused by their guerrilla-like tactics. To alter the dynamic, you must first recognize that there is far less helplessness in their behavior than they let on. Second, these people need to feel that everything takes place on their terms. Threaten that desire, and they fight back in underhanded ways. You must never inadvertently feed their rebelliousness by arguing, complaining, trying to push them in a direction. This makes them feel more under attack, more like a victim, and encourages passive revenge. Instead, move within their system of control, applying Erickson's utilization technique. Be sympathetic to their plight, but make it seem that whatever they do, they are actually cooperating with your own desires. That will put them off balance. If they rebel now, they are playing into your hands. The dynamic will subtly shift, and you will have room to insinuate change. Similarly, if the other person wields a fundamental weakness as a weapon, the heart attack tactic, make that threat impossible to use against you by taking it further, to the point of parody or painfulness. The only way to beat passive opponents is to outdo them in subtle control. Reversal. This strategy has no reversal. Any effort to seem not to control a situation, to refuse to influence a relationship, is in fact a form of control. By ceding power to others, you have gained a kind of passive authority that you can use later for your own purposes. You are also the one determining who has control by relinquishing it to the other side. There is no escape from the control dynamic. Those who say they are doing so are playing the most insidious control game of all. Here are further reflections on forcing strategies. From The Book of Five Rings by Miyamoto Musashi. Pressing down the pillow refers to one's efforts not to let the head of one's opponent rise. In battles based on martial strategy, it is taboo to let your opponent take the initiative, thus putting yourself on the defensive. You must try at all costs to lead your opponent by taking complete control of him. During combat, your opponent intends to dominate you as much as you want to dominate him, so it is vital that you pick up on your opponent's intentions and tactics so as to control him. According to the principle of martial strategy, you must be able to control your opponents at all times. Study this point well. By Napoleon Bonaparte. In short, I think like Frederick the Great. One should always be the first to attack. By Karl von Clausewitz. Given the same amount of intelligence, timidity will do 1,000 times more damage in war than audacity. From the Iliad, by Homer. When they came to the ford of Xanthus, the eddying river that Zeus begot, Achilles split the Trojans. Half he chased toward the city, across the plain where yesterday the Greeks had fled from Hector's shining rage. Hera, to slow this stampede of Trojans, spread a curtain of fog between them. The others swerved and found themselves herded into the river. They crashed down into the deep silver water as it tumbled and roared through its banks. You could hear their screams as they floundered and were whirled around in the eddies. Fire will sometimes cause a swarm of locusts to rise in the air and fly to a river. The fire keeps coming, burning them instantly, and the insects shrink down into the water. Just so Achilles. And Xanthus's noisy channel was clogged with chariots, horses, and men. Achilles wasted no time. Leaving his spear propped against a tamarisk and holding only his sword, he leapt from the bank like a spirit from hell bent on slaughter. He struck over and over in a widening spiral. Hideous groans rose from the wounded, and the river water turned crimson with blood. Fish fleeing a dolphin's huge maw hide by the hundreds in the harbor's crannies, but the dolphin devours whatever it catches. Likewise the Trojans beneath the riverbanks. From On War, by Karl von Clausewitz. Let us admit that boldness in war even has its own prerogatives. It must be granted a certain power over and above successful calculations involving space, time, and magnitude of forces. For wherever it is superior, it will take advantage of its opponent's weakness. In other words, it is a genuinely creative force. This fact is not difficult to prove even scientifically. Whenever boldness encounters timidity, it is likely to be the winner, because timidity in itself implies a loss of equilibrium. Boldness will be at a disadvantage only in an encounter with deliberate caution, which may be considered bold in its own right, and is certainly just as powerful and effective. But such cases are rare. Timidity is the root of prudence in the majority of men. The higher up the chain of command, the greater is the need for boldness to be supported by a reflective mind, so that boldness does not degenerate into purposeless bursts of blind passion. From The Greek Myths, by Robert Graves. The Olympians could now join battle with the giants. Heracles let loose his first arrow against Alcyoneus, the enemy's leader. He fell to the ground, but sprang up again revived, because this was his native soil of Phlegra. "Quick, noble Heracles," cried Athena, "drag him away to another country." Heracles caught Alcyoneus up on his shoulders and dragged him over the Thracian border, where he dispatched him with a club. From My Bondage and My Freedom, by Frederick Douglass. Well, my dear reader, this battle with Mr. Covey, undignified as it was, and as I fear my narration of it is, was the turning point in my life as a slave. It rekindled in my breast the smoldering embers of liberty. It brought up my Baltimore dreams and revived a sense of my own manhood. I was a changed being after that fight. I was nothing before. I was a man now. It recalled to life my crushed self-respect and my self-confidence, and inspired me with a renewed determination to be a free man. A man without force is without the essential dignity of humanity. Human nature is so constituted that it cannot honor a helpless man, although it can pity him. And even this it cannot do long if the signs of power do not arise. He only can understand the effect of this combat on my spirit, who has himself incurred something, hazarded something, in repelling the unjust and cruel aggressions of a tyrant. Covey was a tyrant, and a cowardly one withal. After resisting him, I felt as I had never felt before. It was a resurrection from the dark and pestiferous tomb of slavery to the heaven of comparative freedom. I was no longer a servile coward, trembling under the frown of a brother worm of the dust, but my long cowed spirit was roused to an attitude of manly independence. I had reached a point at which I was not afraid to die. This spirit made me a free man in fact, while I remained a slave in form. When a slave cannot be flogged, he is more than half free. He has a domain as broad as his own manly heart to defend, and he is really a power on earth. While slaves prefer their lives with flogging to instant death, they will always find Christians enough, like unto Covey, to accommodate that preference. From this time, until that of my escape from slavery, I was never fairly whipped. Several attempts were made to whip me, but they were always unsuccessful. Bruises I did get, as I shall hereafter inform the reader. But the case I have been describing was the end of the brutification to which slavery had subjected me. And lastly, by Joe Frazier. It is not the same when a fighter moves because he wants to move, and another when he moves because he has to. Chapter 16. Hit Them Where It Hurts. The Center of Gravity Strategy. Everyone has a source of power on which he or she depends. When you look at your rivals, search below the surface for that source, the center of gravity that holds the entire structure together. That center can be their wealth, their popularity, a key position, a winning strategy. Hitting them there will inflict disproportionate pain. Find what the other side most cherishes and protects. That is where you must strike. Pillars of Collapse. In 210 BC, a young Roman general named Publius Scipio the Younger, later called Scipio Africanus, was sent to northeastern Spain with a simple mission: to hold the Ebro River against the powerful Carthaginian armies that were threatening to cross it and take control of the peninsula. This was Scipio's first assignment as commander, and as he looked out on the river and plotted his strategy, he felt a strange mix of emotions. 8 years earlier, the great Carthaginian commander Hannibal had crossed this river, heading north. Onward he had gone into Gaul, and then, catching the Romans by surprise, had crossed the Alps into Italy. Scipio, only 18 at the time, had fought alongside his father, a general, in the first battles against Hannibal on Italian soil. He had seen the North African's battlefield skills with his own eyes. Hannibal had maneuvered his small army brilliantly, made maximum use of his superior cavalry, and through inexhaustible creativity had constantly managed to surprise the Romans and inflict on them a series of humiliating defeats, culminating in the virtual annihilation of the Roman legions in the Battle of Cannae in 216 BC. Matching wits with Hannibal, Scipio knew, was futile. It had seemed back then that Rome itself was doomed. Scipio also recalled two events after Cannae that had had an overwhelming effect on him. First, a Roman general named Fabius had finally conceived a strategy to keep Hannibal at bay. Keeping his legions in the hills and avoiding direct battle, Fabius had launched hit-and-run raids designed to wear down the Carthaginians, who were fighting far from their home in what is now Tunisia. The campaign had worked as a holding action, but to Scipio it had seemed equally exhausting for the Romans to fight so long and still have the enemy at their doorstep. Also, since the plan could not lead to any real defeat of Hannibal, it was basically flawed. Second, a year into Hannibal's invasion, the Romans had sent Scipio's father to Spain to try to knock out the Carthaginian bases there. Carthage had had colonies in Spain for many years and earned wealth from Spanish mines. It used Spain as a training ground for its soldiers and as the base for its war on Rome. For 6 years, Scipio's father had fought the Carthaginians on the Spanish peninsula, but the campaign had ended in his defeat and death in 211 BC. As Scipio studied the reports coming in about the situation beyond the Ebro, a plan took root in his mind. With one bold maneuver, he could avenge his father's death the year before, demonstrate the effectiveness of a strategy he thought far better than Fabius's, and set in motion the eventual collapse, not just of Hannibal, but of Carthage itself. Along the coast to the south of him was the city of New Carthage, present-day Cartagena, the Carthaginians' capital in Spain. There they stored their vast wealth, their army supplies, and the hostages they had taken from different Spanish tribes to be held as ransom in case of rebellion. At this moment, the Carthaginian armies, which outnumbered the Romans 2-1, were scattered about the country, trying to gain further domination over the Spanish tribes, and were all several days' march from New Carthage. Their commanders, Scipio learned, had been quarreling among themselves over power and money. Meanwhile, New Carthage was garrisoned with only 1,000 men. Disobeying his orders to take his stand at the Ebro, Scipio advanced south by ship and led a daring raid on New Carthage. This walled city was considered impregnable, but he timed his attack for the ebbing of the tide in a lagoon on the city's north side. There, his men were able to scale the walls relatively easily, and New Carthage was taken. In one move, Scipio had produced a dramatic turnaround. Now the Romans commanded the central position in Spain. They had the money and supplies on which the Carthaginians in Spain depended, and they had Carthage's hostages, whom they now could use to stir revolt among the conquered tribes. Over the next few years, Scipio exploited this position and slowly brought Spain under Roman control. In 205 BC, Scipio returned to Rome a hero, but Hannibal was still a menace in Italy's interior. Scipio now wanted to take the war to Africa by marching on Carthage itself. That was the only way to get Hannibal out of Italy and finally erase Carthage as a threat. But Fabius was still the commander in charge of Rome's strategy, and few saw the point of fighting Hannibal by waging war so far from him and from Rome. Yet Scipio's prestige was high, and the Roman Senate finally gave him an army, a small, low-quality army, to use for his campaign. Wasting no time on arguing his case, Scipio proceeded to make an alliance with Massinissa, king of the Massiles, Carthage's neighbors. Massinissa would supply him with a large and well-trained cavalry. Then, in the spring of 204 BC, Scipio sailed for Africa and landed near Utica, not far from Carthage. Initially surprised, the Carthaginians rallied and were able to pin Scipio's troops on a peninsula outside the town. The situation looked bleak. If Scipio could somehow advance past the enemy troops that blocked his path, he would enter the heart of the enemy state and gain control of the situation. But that seemed an impossible task. He could not hope to fight his way past the tight Carthaginian cordon, trapped where he was. His supplies would eventually run out, forcing him to surrender. Scipio bargained for peace, but used the negotiations as a way to spy on the Carthaginian army. Scipio's ambassadors told him that the enemy had two camps, one for its own army, and the other for its main ally, the Numidians, whose camp was rather disorganized, a swarm of reed huts. The Carthaginian camp was more orderly, but made of the same combustible materials. Over the next few weeks, Scipio seemed indecisive, first breaking off negotiations, then reopening them, confusing the Carthaginians. Then one night he made a sneak attack on the Numidian camp and set it on fire. The blaze spread quickly, and the African soldiers panicked, scattering in every direction. Awakened by the hubbub, the Carthaginians opened the gates to their own camp to come to their allies' rescue. But in the confusion, the Romans were able to steal in and set fire to their camp as well. The enemy lost half their army in this battle by night, the rest managing to retreat to Numidia and Carthage. Suddenly, the Carthaginian interior lay open to Scipio's army. He proceeded to take town after town, advancing much as Hannibal had in Italy. Then, he landed a contingent of troops at the port of Tunis, within sight of Carthage's walls. Now it was the Carthaginians' turn to panic, and Hannibal, their greatest general, was immediately recalled. In 202 BC, after 16 years of fighting on Rome's doorstep, Hannibal was finally compelled to leave Italy. Hannibal landed his army to Carthage's south and made plans to fight Scipio. But the Roman general retreated west, to the Bagradus Valley, the most fertile farmlands of Carthage, its economic base. There he went on a rampage, destroying everything in sight. Hannibal had wanted to fight near Carthage, where he had shelter and material reinforcements. Instead, he was compelled to pursue Scipio before Carthage lost its richest territory. But Scipio kept retreating, refusing battle until he had lured Hannibal to the town of Zama, where he secured a solid position and forced Hannibal to camp in a place without water. Now the two armies finally met in battle. Exhausted by their pursuit of Scipio, their cavalry neutralized by Massinissus, the Carthaginians were defeated, and with no refuge close enough to retreat to, Hannibal was forced to surrender. Carthage quickly sued for peace, and under the harsh terms imposed by Scipio and the Senate, it was reduced to a client state of Rome. As a Mediterranean power and a threat to Rome, Carthage was finished for good. Interpretation. Often what separates a mediocre general from a superior one is not their strategies or maneuvers, but their vision. They simply look at the same problem from a different angle. Freed from the stranglehold of convention, the superior general naturally hits on the right strategy. The Romans were dazzled by Hannibal's strategic genius. They came to so fear him that the only strategies they could use against him were delay and avoidance. Scipio Africanus simply saw differently. At every turn he looked not at the enemy army, nor even at its leader, but at the pillar of support on which it stood, its critical vulnerability. He understood that military power was located not in the army itself, but in its foundations, the things that supported it and made it possible. Money, supplies, public goodwill, allies. He found those pillars, and bit by bit, knocked them down. Scipio's first step was to see Spain, not Italy, as Hannibal's center of gravity. Within Spain, the key was New Carthage. He did not chase the various Roman armies, but took New Carthage and turned the war around. Now Hannibal, deprived of his main military base and source of supply, would have to lean more heavily on his other support base, Carthage itself, with its wealth and resources. So Scipio took the war to Africa. Trapped near Utica, he examined what gave the enemy its power in this situation, and saw that it was not the armies themselves, but the position they had taken. Get them to move out of that position without wasting men in a frontal battle, and Carthage's soft underbelly would be exposed. By burning the camps, Scipio moved the armies. Then, instead of marching on the city of Carthage, a glittering prize that would have drawn most generals like a magnet, he hit what would hurt the Carthaginian state most, the fertile farming zone that was the source of its wealth. Finally, instead of chasing Hannibal, he made Hannibal come after him, to an area in the middle of the country where he would be deprived of reinforcements and support. Now that Scipio had unbalanced the Carthaginians so completely, their defeat at Zama was definitive. Power is deceptive. If we imagine the enemy as a boxer, we tend to focus on his punch. But still more than he depends on his punch, he depends on his legs. Once they go weak, he loses balance. He cannot escape the other fighter. He is subject to grueling exchanges, and his punches gradually diminish in force until he is knocked out. When you look at your rivals, do not be distracted by their punch. To engage in any exchange of punches, in life or in war, is the height of stupidity and waste. Power depends on balance and support. So look at what is holding your enemy up, and remember that what holds him up can also make him fall. A person, like an army, usually gets his or her power from three or four simultaneous sources. Money, popularity, skillful maneuvering, some particular advantage he has fostered. Knock out one, and he will have to depend more on the others. Knock out those, and he is lost. Weaken a boxer's legs, and he will reel and stagger. And when he does, be merciless. No power can stand without its legs. By Ming Dynasty strategist Jia Xuan. When the veins are removed from an arrow, even though the shaft and tip remain, it is difficult for the arrow to penetrate deeply. Keys to Warfare. It is natural in war to focus on the physical aspect of conflict, bodies, equipment, materiel. Even an enlightened strategist will tend to look first at the enemy's army, firepower, mobility, reserves. War is a visceral, emotional affair, an arena of physical danger, and it takes great effort to rise above this level and ask different questions. What makes the enemy army move? What gives it impetus and endurance? Who guides its actions? What is the underlying source of its strength? Most people have the problem of seeing war as a separate activity, unrelated to other realms of human life. But in fact, war is a form of power. Karl von Clausewitz called it politics by other means. And all forms of power share the same essential structures. The most visible thing about power is its outward manifestation, what its witnesses see and feel. An army has its size, its weaponry, its shows of discipline, its aggressive maneuvers. Individuals have many ways of showing their position and influence. It is the nature of power to present a forceful front, to seem menacing and intimidating, strong and decisive. But this outward display is often exaggerated or even downright deceptive, since power does not dare show its weaknesses. And beneath a display is the support on which power rests, its center of gravity. The phrase is von Clausewitz, who elaborated it as the hub of all power and movement on which everything depends. This is the part that governs the whole, a kind of nerve center. To attack this center of gravity, to neutralize or destroy it, is the ultimate strategy in war, for without it the whole structure will collapse. The enemy may have great generals and strong armies, like Hannibal and his invincible army in Italy, but without a center of gravity those armies cannot move and have no force or coherence. Hitting the center will have devastating psychological effects, throwing the enemy off balance, and inducing a creeping panic. If conventional generals look at the physical aspect of the enemy army, focusing on its weaknesses and trying to exploit them, superior strategists look behind and beyond, to the support system. The enemy's center of gravity is where an injury will hurt him most, his point of greatest vulnerability. Hitting him there is the best way to end a conflict definitively and economically. The key is analyzing the enemy force to determine its centers of gravity. In looking for those centers, it is crucial not to be misled by the intimidating or dazzling exterior, mistaking the outward appearance for what sets it in motion. You will probably have to take several steps, one by one, to uncover this ultimate power source, peeling away layer after layer. Remember Scipio, who saw first that Hannibal depended on Spain, then that Spain depended on Carthage, then that Carthage depended on its material prosperity, which itself had particular sources. Strike at Carthage's prosperity, as Scipio eventually did, and the whole thing would fall apart. To find a group's center of gravity, you must understand its structure and the culture within which it operates. If your enemies are individuals, you must fathom their psychology, what makes them tick, the structure of their thinking and priorities. In crafting a strategy to defeat the United States in the Vietnam War, General Vaught Nguyen Giáp determined that the real center of gravity in the American democracy was the political support of its citizens. Given that support, the kind of support the military had had during World War II, the country could prosecute a war with the utmost effectiveness. Without that support, though, the effort was doomed. Through the Tet Offensive of 1968, Giáp was able to undermine the American public's support for the war. He had gained an understanding of American culture that allowed him to aim at the right target. The more centralized the enemy, the more devastating becomes a blow at its leader or governing body. Hernan Cortes was able to conquer Mexico with a handful of soldiers by capturing Moctezuma, the Aztec emperor. Moctezuma was the center around which everything revolved. Without him, Aztec culture quickly collapsed. When Napoleon invaded Russia in 1812, he assumed that by taking Moscow, the capital, he could force the Russians to surrender. But the true center of gravity in this authoritarian nation was the Tsar, who was determined to continue the war. The loss of Moscow only steeled his resolve. A more decentralized enemy will have several separate centers of gravity. The key here is to disorganize them by cutting off communications between them. That was what General Douglas MacArthur did in his remarkable campaign in the Pacific during World War II. He skipped some islands, but took key ones, keeping the Japanese extended over a vast area and making it impossible for them to communicate with each other. It is almost always strategically wise to disrupt your enemy's lines of communication. If the parts cannot communicate with the whole, chaos ensues. Your enemy's center of gravity can be something abstract, like a quality, concept, or aptitude on which he depends, his reputation, his capacity to deceive, his unpredictability. But such strengths become critical vulnerabilities if you can make them unattractive or unusable. In fighting the Scythians, in what is now modern-day Iran, a tribe that no one could figure out how to defeat, Alexander the Great saw the center of gravity as their complete mobility on horseback and their fluid, almost chaotic style of fighting. He simply plotted to neutralize the source of this power by luring them on to enclosed ground in which they could not use their cavalry and pell-mell tactics. He defeated them with ease. To find an enemy's center of gravity, you have to erase your own tendency to think in conventional terms or to assume that the other side's center is the same as your own. When Salvador Dali came to the United States in 1940, intent on conquering the country as an artist and making his fortune, he made a clever calculation. In the European art world, an artist had to win over the critics and make a name as serious. In America, though, that kind of fame would doom an artist to a ghetto, a limited circle. The real center of gravity was the American media. By wooing the newspapers, he would gain access to the American public, and the American public would make him a star. Again, in the civil war between communists and nationalists for control of China in the late 1920s and early 30s, most of the communists focused on taking cities, as the Bolsheviks had done in Russia. But Mao Zedong, an outsider within the dogmatic Chinese Communist Party, was able to look at China in a clear light and see China's center of gravity as its vast peasant population. Win them to his side, he believed, and the revolution could not fail. That single insight proved the key to the communists' success. Such is the power of identifying the center of gravity. We often hide our sources of power from view. What most people consider a center of gravity is often a front. But sometimes an enemy will reveal his center of gravity by what he protects the most fervently. In bringing the Civil War into Georgia, General William Tecumseh Sherman discovered that the South was particularly anxious to protect Atlanta and the areas around it. That was the South's industrial center of gravity. Like Sherman, attack what the enemy most treasures, or threaten it to make the enemy divert forces to defend itself. In any group, power and influence will naturally devolve to a handful of people behind the scenes. That kind of power works best when it is not exposed to the light of day. Once you discover this coterie holding the strings, win it over. As president during the Depression, Franklin Roosevelt faced problems from so many sides that it was difficult for him to know where his energy should go. In the end, he decided that the key to enacting his reforms was winning over Congress. Then, within Congress, there were particular leaders who held the real power. He concentrated on wooing and seducing these leaders with his great charm. It was one of the secrets to his success. What ultimately guides a group is the command and control center, the operational brain that takes in information, then makes the crucial decisions. Disrupting the functioning of that brain will cause dislocation throughout the enemy army. Before almost every battle, Alexander the Great would examine the enemy's organization, pinpointing as best he could the location of the command structure, then either attacking it or isolating it, making it impossible for the brain to communicate with the body. Even in a sport as physical as boxing, Muhammad Ali, in crafting a strategy to defeat his arch-nemesis, Joe Frazier, took aim at Frazier's mind, the ultimate center of gravity for any individual. Before every fight, Ali would get under Frazier's skin, riling him up by calling him an Uncle Tom, a tool of the white man's media. He would keep going during the fight itself, taunting Frazier mercilessly in the ring. Frazier became obsessed with Ali, could not think about him without bursting with anger. Controlling Frazier's mind was the key to controlling his body. In any interaction with people, you must train yourself to focus on their strength, the source of their power, whatever it is that gives them their most crucial support. That knowledge will afford you many strategic options, many angles from which to attack, subtly or not so subtly undermining their strength rather than hitting it head on. You can create no greater sense of panic in your enemies than that of being unable to use their strengths. Reversal. Every living creature has a center of gravity. Even the most decentralized group has to communicate and depends on a network that is vulnerable to attack. There is no reversal to this principle. Here are further reflections on the center of gravity strategy. From The Wiles of War, 36 Military Strategies from Ancient China. Man depends on his throat for fluent breathing and the maintenance of life. When his throat is strangled, his five sense organs will lose their sensibility and no longer function normally. He will not be able to stretch his limbs, which become numb and paralyzed. The man can therefore rarely survive. Thus, when the banners of the enemy come into sight, and the beating of its battle drums can be heard, we must first ascertain the positions of its back and throat. Then we can attack it from the back and strangle its throat. This is an excellent strategy to crush the enemy. From The Sword and the Mind. The third shogun, Iemitsu, was fond of sword matches. Once, when he arranged to see some of his outstanding swordsmen display their skills, he spotted, among the gathering, a master equestrian by the name of Suwa Bunkuro, and impulsively asked him to take part. Bunkuro responded by saying that he would be pleased to if he could fight on horseback, adding that he could defeat anyone on horseback. Iemitsu was delighted to urge the swordsman to fight Bunkuro in the style he preferred. As it turned out, Bunkuro was right in his boasting. Brandishing a sword on a prancing horse wasn't something many swordsmen were used to, and Bunkuro easily defeated everyone who dared face him on horseback. Somewhat exasperated, Iemitsu told Munenori to give it a try. Though a bystander on this occasion, Munenori at once complied and mounted a horse. As his horse trotted up to Bunkuro's, Munenori suddenly stopped his horse and slapped the nose of Bunkuro's horse with his wooden sword. Bunkuro's horse reared, and while the famed equestrian was trying to restore his balance, Munenori struck him off his horse. From the Greek Myths by Robert Graves. Heracles did not return to Mycenae by a direct route. He first traversed Libya, whose king Antaeus, son of Poseidon and Mother Earth, was in the habit of forcing strangers to wrestle with him until they were exhausted, whereupon he killed them. For not only was he a strong and skillful athlete, but whenever he touched the earth, his strength revived. He saved the skulls of his victims to roof a temple of Poseidon. It is not known whether Heracles, who was determined to end this barbarous practice, challenged Antaeus or was challenged by him. Antaeus, however, proved no easy victim, being a giant who lived in a cave beneath a towering cliff, where he feasted on the flesh of lions and slept on the bare ground in order to conserve and increase his already colossal strength. Mother Earth, not yet sterile after her birth of the giant, had conceived Antaeus in a Libyan cave, and found more reason to boast of him than ever of her monstrous elder children, Typhon, Tityus, and Briareus. It would have gone ill with the Olympians if he had fought against them on the plains of Phlegra. In preparation for the wrestling match, both combatants cast off their lion pelts, but while Heracles rubbed himself with oil in the Olympian fashion, Antaeus poured hot sand over his limbs, lest contact with the earth through the soles of his feet alone should prove insufficient. Heracles planned to preserve his strength and wear Antaeus down, but after tossing him full length on the ground, he was amazed to see the giant's muscles swell and a healthy flush suffuse his limbs as Mother Earth revived him. The combatants grappled again, and presently Antaeus flung himself down of his own accord, not waiting to be thrown, upon which Heracles, realizing what he was at, lifted him high into the air, then cracked his ribs, and despite the hollow groans of Mother Earth, held him aloft until he died. And lastly, from the book of Judith. The people of Israel cried out to the Lord their God, for their courage failed, because all their enemies had surrounded them, and there was no way of escape from them. The whole Assyrian army, their infantry, chariots, and cavalry, surrounded them for 34 days, until all the vessels of water belonging to every inhabitant of Bethulia were empty. Their children lost heart, and the women and young men fainted from thirst and fell down in the streets of the city and in the passages through the gates. There was no strength left in them any longer. When Judith had ceased crying out to the God of Israel and had ended all these words, she rose from where she lay prostrate and called her maid and went down into the house where she lived on Sabbaths and on her feast days. And she removed the sackcloth which she had been wearing, and took off her widow's garments, and bathed her body with water, and anointed herself with precious ointment, and combed her hair, and put on a tiara, and arrayed herself in her gayest apparel, which she used to wear while her husband Manasseh was living. And she put sandals on her feet, and put on her anklets and bracelets and rings, and her earrings, and all her ornaments, and made herself very beautiful, to entice the eyes of all men who might see her. The women went straight on through the valley, and an Assyrian patrol met her and took her into custody, and asked her, "To what people do you belong, and where are you going?" She replied, "I am a daughter of the Hebrews, but I am fleeing from them, for they are about to be handed over to you to be devoured. I am on my way to the presence of Holofernes, the commander of your army, to give him a true report. And I will show him a way by which he can go and capture all the hill country without losing one of his men, captured or slain." When the man heard her words and observed her face, she was in their eyes marvelously beautiful, they said to her, "Go at once to his tent, and when you stand before him, do not be afraid in your heart, but tell him just what you have said, and he will treat you well." Her words pleased Holofernes and all his servants, and they marveled at her wisdom, and said, "There is no such a woman from one end of the earth to the other, either for beauty of face or wisdom of speech." On the fourth day, Holofernes held a banquet for his slaves only, and did not invite any of his officers. And he said to Bagoas, the eunuch who had charge of all his personal affairs, "Go now and persuade the Hebrew woman who was in your care to join us, and eat and drink with us." So Bagoas went out from the presence of Holofernes and approached her. And Judith said, "Who am I to refuse my lord? Surely whatever pleases him I will do at once, and it will be a joy to me until the day of my death." So she got up and arrayed herself in all her woman's finery. Then Judith came in and lay down, and Holofernes' heart was ravished with her, and he was moved with great desire to possess her, for he had been waiting for an opportunity to deceive her ever since the day he first saw her. So Holofernes said to her, "Drink now and be merry with us." Judith said, "I will drink now, my lord, because my life means more to me today than in all the days since I was born." And Holofernes was greatly pleased with her, and drank a great quantity of wine, much more than he had ever drunk in any one day since he was born. When evening came, his slaves quickly withdrew, and Bagoas closed the tent from outside, and shut out the attendants from his master's presence, and they went to bed. So Judith was left alone in the tent, with Holofernes stretched out on his bed, for he was overcome with wine. Judith went to the post at the end of the bed, above Holofernes' head, and took down his sword that hung there. She came close to his bed and took a hold of the hair on his head, and she struck his neck twice with all her might, and severed his head from his body. Then she tumbled his body off the bed and pulled the canopy from the posts. After a moment she went out and gave Holofernes' head to her maid, who placed it in her food bag. So Bagoas went into the bedchamber and found him thrown down on the platform dead with his head cut off and missing. And he cried out with a loud voice and wept and groaned. Then he went to the tent where Judith had stayed, and when he did not find her, he rushed out to the people and shouted, "The slaves have tricked us. One Hebrew woman has brought disgrace upon the house of Nebuchadnezzar. For look, here is Holofernes lying on the ground, and his head is not on him." When the leaders of the Assyrian army heard this, they rent their tunics and were greatly dismayed, and their loud cries and shouts arose in the midst of the camp. When the men in the tents heard it, they were amazed at what had happened. Fear and trembling came over them, so that they did not wait for one another, but with one impulse all rushed out and fled by every path across the plain and through the country. Then the men of Israel, every one that was a soldier, rushed out upon them. And when the Israelites heard it, with one accord they fell upon the enemy, and cut them down as far as Chobah. Chapter 17. Defeat them in detail. The divide and conquer strategy. When you look at your enemies, do not be intimidated by their appearance. Instead, look at the parts that make up the whole. By separating the parts, sowing dissension and division from within, you can weaken and bring down even the most formidable foe. In setting up your attack, work on their minds to create internal conflict. Look for the joints and links, the things that connect the people in a group or connect one group to another. Division is weakness, and the joints are the weakest part of any structure. When you are facing troubles or enemies, turn a large problem into small, eminently defeatable parts. The central position. One day in early August of 490 BC, the citizens of Athens received word that a massive Persian fleet had just landed some 24 miles to the north, along the coastal plains of Marathon. A mood of doom quickly spread. Every Athenian knew Persia's intentions: to capture their city, destroy its young democracy, and restore a former tyrant, Hippias, to the throne, and sell many of its citizens into slavery. Some 8 years earlier, Athens had sent ships to support the Greek cities of Asia Minor in a rebellion against King Darius, ruler of the Persian Empire. The Athenians had sailed home after a few battles. They soon saw that this business was hopeless, but they had participated in burning down the city of Sardis, an unforgivable outrage, and Darius wanted revenge. The Athenians' predicament seemed desperate. The Persian army was enormous, some 80,000 men strong, transported by hundreds of ships. It had excellent cavalry and the best archers in the world. The Athenians, meanwhile, had only infantry, some 10,000 strong. They had sent a runner to Sparta urgently requesting reinforcements, but the Spartans were celebrating their moon festival, and it was taboo to fight during such a time. They would send troops as soon as they could, within a week, but that would probably be too late. Meanwhile, a group of Persian sympathizers within Athens, mostly from wealthy families, despised the democracy, looked forward to Hippias's return, and were doing their best to sow dissension and betray the city from within. Not only would the Athenians have to fight the Persians alone, but they were divided into factions among themselves. The leaders of democratic Athens gathered to discuss the alternatives, all of which seemed bad. The majority argued for concentrating the Athenian forces outside the city in a defensive cordon. There they could wait to fight the Persians on terrain they knew well. The Persian army, however, was large enough to surround the city by both land and sea, choking it off with a blockade. So one leader, Miltiades, made a very different proposal: to march the entire Athenian army immediately toward Marathon, to a place where the road to Athens passed through a narrow pass along the coast. That would leave Athens itself unprotected. In trying to block the Persian advance on land, it would open itself to an attack by sea. But Miltiades argued that occupying the pass was the only way to avoid being surrounded. He had fought the Persians in Asia Minor, and was the Athenians' most experienced soldier. The leaders voted for his plan. And so, a few days later, the 10,000 Athenian infantrymen began the march north, slaves carrying their heavy body armor, mules and donkeys transporting their food. When they reached the pass, looking down on the plains of Marathon, their hearts sank. As far as the eye could see, the long strip of land was filled with tents, horses, and soldiers from all over the Persian Empire. Ships cluttered the coast. For several days, neither side moved. The Athenians had no choice but to hold their position. Without cavalry and hopelessly outnumbered, how could they do battle at Marathon? If enough time went by, perhaps the Spartans would arrive as reinforcements. But what were the Persians waiting for? Before dawn on August 12th, some Greek scouts, ostensibly working for the Persians, slipped across to the Athenian side and reported startling news. Under cover of darkness, the Persians had just sailed for the Bay of Phalerin outside Athens, taking most of their cavalry with them and leaving a holding force of some 15,000 soldiers in the plains of Marathon. They would take Athens from the sea, then march north, squeezing the Athenian army at Marathon between two larger forces. Of the Athenian army's 11 commanders, Miltiades alone seemed calm, even relieved. This was their opportunity. As the sun was getting ready to rise, he argued for an immediate attack on the Persians at Marathon. Some of the other commanders resisted this idea. The enemy still had more men, some cavalry, and plenty of archers. Better to wait for the Spartans, who would surely arrive soon. But Miltiades countered that the Persians had divided their forces. He had fought them before and knew that the Greek infantryman was superior in discipline and spirit. The Persians at Marathon now only slightly outnumbered the Greeks. They could fight them and win. Meanwhile, even with a good wind, it would take the Persian ships 10 to 12 hours to round the coast and arrive at the Bay of Phalerin. Then they would need more time to disembark the troops and horses. If the Athenians defeated the Persians at Marathon quickly, they would have just enough time to run back to Athens and defend the city the same day. If instead they opted to wait, the Spartans might never arrive. The Persians would surround them, and more ominously, the Persian sympathizers within Athens would probably betray the city from within and open its walls to the barbarians. It was now or never. By a vote of 6-5, the commanders decided to attack at dawn. At 6 in the morning, the Athenians began their charge. A hail of arrows from the Persian archers rained down on them, but they closed in on the enemy so quickly that the battle now had to be fought hand to hand. And, as Miltiades had foreseen, in close combat the Athenians were superior. They pushed the Persians back into the marshes at the north end of the plain, where thousands drowned. The waters reddened with blood. By 9 in the morning, the Athenians had control of the plains, having lost fewer than 200 men. Although emotionally spent by this battle, the Athenians now had only around 7 hours to make the 24 miles back to Athens in time to stop the Persians. There was simply no time to rest. They ran as fast as their feet could take them, loaded down in their heavy armor, impelled by the thought of the imminent dangers facing their families and fellow citizens. By 4 in the afternoon, the fastest among them had straggled to a point overlooking the Bay of Phaleron. The rest soon followed. Within a matter of minutes after their arrival, the Persian fleet sailed into the bay to see a most unwelcome sight. Thousands of Athenian soldiers, caked in dust and blood, standing shoulder to shoulder to fight the landing. The Persians rode at anchor for a few hours, then headed out to sea, returning.